the contrast between the Mahayana and the Theravada presentation of the Eightfold Way is of some interest. The Mahayana presents it as follows. Perfect understanding, in which two stages of the Aryan path are distinguished. A state of collectedness. In a state of collectedness, one sees the Four Noble Truths face to face. Afterwards, bringing back this experience to practice it in daily life. The second one is perfect examination, whereby the causes for the realization of voidness and its characteristics are examined. This voidness is the essence of all Lord Buddha's discourses, while this examination ascertains the ways and means by which others may be led to understand. Perfect speech. Although the void is not manifold and thus cannot be expressed in words, still one can talk about it from a practical point of view. It is this perfect speech which causes others to know about the unmanifold void by teaching them in speech and by the written word, so that they become established in perfect understanding. It is thus the freedom from all false speech. In other words, this refers to the Buddha's statement in the Brahmajala Sutta, in the Theravada, about himself, that he speaks only about religion. The fourth, perfect action. Naturally, the conduct of the noble ones always accords with the Dharma, so that this factor establishes the practicer in pure precepts. It may also be called pure bodily action. Perfect livelihood. Ariyas or noble ones always have pure livelihood, since their living is never mixed up with wrong ways of life. The noble one's conduct is free of crooked bodily and verbal expression, such as exhibiting his virtues in front of others. Now, this accords very closely to the Theravada presentation. Perfect effort, which is a kind of mind development with use of the thinking wisdom to develop the experience of voidness already realized. That is perfect effort.
Would you mind saying that again?
Perfect effort is a kind of mind development with use of the thinking wisdom to develop the experience of voidness already realized. The seventh, perfect mindfulness. When Ariyas, the noble ones that is, attain calm and insight, their main objects for reflection and investigation are the Four Noble Truths. The function of perfect mindfulness is to maintain these objects in their minds, not letting these truths become lost. The stain which causes forgetfulness is opposed by this path factor. Here, of course, there is a considerable difference from the presentation in the Theravada. Perfect mindfulness is with respect to the body as you go along in your daily life, your feelings, your thoughts, mental objects, and so on. Finally, perfect collectedness. This pure collected state of mind stands opposed to and frees one from the stains of what Vimahayana calls sinking and scattering. By this perfect collectedness, one advances further and further along the path. This again is somewhat different from the Theravada presentation. If you were to get a copy of this book, the Dalai Lama's book, and compare it with the Theravada presentation as such, you will see the contrasts. Very briefly, this presents the Eightfold Path more in a transcendental sense than in the ordinary empirical sense of our everyday life here. That is a stronger leaning towards the transcendental. Now, in presenting the Mahayana, the great vehicle, as it is called, the Dalai Lama points out four factors in connection with it. One which is called the path of accumulation, which in brief means that manifold merits are gathered. Then there is the path of endeavor, and here insight into voidness becomes progressively clearer and the dualism of subject and object begins to disappear. Third is the path of insight, which arises after the experience of the sublime dharmas when there is an unobstructed realization of voidness. You will see that the emphasis constantly is upon shunyata, voidness, and the realization of shunyata. Then there is the fourth path, which he calls the path of development, the bhavana marga. And I mention this only because he talks of 10 levels which a bodhisattva practices to gain. And those of you who are acquainted and particularly deeply versed in the various mysticisms of the world will see quite interesting points of contact. These 10 levels are presented as follows: the joyous, the pure, the light maker, the radiant, the invincible, the turning towards, the far ranging, the unshakable, the beneficial, and lastly the cloud of dharma. You look into similar presentations in the Upanishads, you look into similar presentations in the Christian mystics, in Sufism, and you will find some very interesting correspondences there. Then he talks about the various bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya. The Dharmakaya is the Buddha body in its absolute state, the Buddha as he is in absolute terms, Dharmakaya, the transcendent altogether. Then there is the Sambhogakaya, the body in which he manifests himself. And this is not a physical body, it is a mind-made body, the body in which he manifests himself in various regions, the realm of the devas, the realm of the gods, and so forth, and speaks to them. This is how it is presented. And the Nirmanakaya is the Buddha as we know him in ordinary physical form. Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, Shakyamuni. there are certain thinkers who don't quite agree with this. They call the Nirmanakaya the subtle body, but that is matter of opinion and so forth. But I think the general consensus is that the Nirmanakaya represents the Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, as we know him and of him. The Sambhogakaya is this mind-made body. The Buddha in fact refers to it in the Mahasakuludayi Sutta, in which he tells Udayin that a course has been laid down, practicing which disciples are able to extract a mind-made body similar to the physical body in every respect. And then, of course, the Dharmakaya is the Buddha in his absoluteness, formless, shapeless, therefore, as an eternal principle, so to say. Now, in connection with this chapter, there is one very interesting point to bear to notice. After practicing, that is, treading the path, when a bodhisattva attains the ultimate stage, when the mind is free from adventitious stains, then the knowledge of not-self nature becomes clear to him, this being called Svabhava Vishuddha Dharmakaya. Never mind the Sanskrit. This cannot be found in the false state of mind in which the adventitious stains are always arising, but is seen only in the stage of Buddhahood attainment. Now, this mind, which is free from adventitious taints, and the knowledge of not-self nature becomes clear to him, is not impermanent, not created by causes and effects, is uncompounded, and therefore never changing. Here is something presented in the Mahayana beyond birth, death. It is not impermanent, not created by causes and effects, is uncompounded, and therefore never changing. It is the state of the aloneness. It is independent. It is not because of something that it has arisen. It is the statement of the Absolute. Well, I think there's one other point here. The paramitas, the perfections. The Mahayana presents six generally. The Theravada in later Pali literature presents 10. The Mahayana perfections are presented as dana, which is giving, charity, generosity, all these terms are used. Sila, virtue, kshanti, patience, and you know how in the Dhammapada the Buddha says patience is the highest austerity. Virya, endeavor, samadhi, collectedness, prajna, wisdom. So we have giving, virtue, patience, endeavor, collectedness, wisdom. In Pali, in the later Pali literature, we have giving, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, determination, energy, patience, truthfulness, friendliness, equanimity. I think that should be sufficient for us to appreciate some of the contrasts of Mahayana with Theravada. Now, the Dharma, as we all know, began in Magadha. Magadha is the region round the modern town of Pataliputra, of Patna, as we call it. The old word, the old name was Pataliputra, modern Patna. And then it spread westwards and southwards in India. Between the 4th and the 3rd centuries BC, there arose rivalry between the East and the West. And in the time of King Ashoka, that is 272 to 232 BC, the first schism arose. There were, on the one hand, the Stavira-vadins, that is, those who followed the doctrine of the elders. And against them arose the Mahasanghikas, the great assemblists, as they were called. The assemblies of the Staviravadins were restricted. They were a somewhat more exclusive aristocratic group, supposed to consist of the arhats as such. But the Mahasanghikas not only had the arhats, but also had monks of lesser attainment included amongst them. It was a rather more democratic group. Their original writings are lost. Now this schism is connected with 5 points which were raised by a monk called Mahadeva. He happened to be, according to the statements of his opponents, a self-ordained monk. And amongst his 5 points, there were 2 which were directed against the arhats. He declared that they were subject to the molestations of the evil one. Their morality was not as perfect as it ought to be. And the second point was that they were not omniscient. Now this point proved very important in the development of the ideal of omniscience in the Mahayana. The Mahasanghikas were more liberal with regard to the Vinaya rules, that is the rules of the discipline for the order. They were less exclusive in relation to the householders. They granted greater spiritual possibilities to women and to the less gifted monks. And authenticity to later scriptures. The Mahasanghikas developed the Bodhisattva ideal. It was, of course, already inherent in the earliest teachings of Buddhism. And historically, they had the important effect of cutting the Buddhist tradition loose from the Buddha of history, making exclusive adherence to his sayings no longer imperative. Consequently, sayings of this sort arose. With one single sound, he, that is the Buddha, expounds all doctrines. He understands things in a moment. His form body is boundless. He neither sleeps nor dreams. Some even said that Shakyamuni, that is Gautama the Buddha, was a magical creation who, on behalf of the supramundane Buddha, had preached the Dharma. But if the true Buddhahood principle exists at all times, instruments therefore can be found for the teaching and so free and unfettered development of the doctrine could be assured. See, all the Mahayana doctrine began to develop centuries after the death of the Buddha. From the Mahasanghikas, there developed a new gospel. It was the Bodhisattva Yana, the Bodhisattva vehicle, later called Mahayana, great vehicle, great because of all-embracing karuna, compassion. Mahakaruna became one of the main pillars of Mahayana teachings, the great compassion. The other great pillar was Mahaprajna, the great wisdom. The Theravada had emphasized wisdom first and foremost. Compassion perhaps was secondary to it. This is the claim of the Mahayana. But with the Mahayana, karuna, compassion, assumed equal importance with wisdom. So, karuna was one of the reasons why the Mahayana called itself the Maha, the great vehicle. Shunyata, because that was a tremendous teaching, and the goal of Buddhahood itself, not confining the goal to arhatship. These three were the main reasons why the Mahayana called itself the great vehicle. Now here, of course, we come up against this conflict. The arhat ideal, as it was called, versus the bodhisattva ideal. The main accusation leveled against those who sought arhatship was that it was the seeking of a selfish nirvana. The arhat was concerned with his own salvation. There was a certain unconcernedness with the world as far as the arhat was concerned. And there is a correspondence with the apatthaya of the Stoics, just to be unconcerned about others. The bodhisattva ideal, on the other hand, was one in which the bodhisattva renounced his own ultimate salvation and remained in touch with human beings, with all creation, in order to help it along into nirvana. And they call this a superior ideal. We may just consider this for a little while. What substantial reality is there in this distinction? Can one realize arhatship without complete compassion? Is it at all possible? Can wisdom be true wisdom if compassion isn't fully developed, as fully developed as the wisdom? The arhat is one who can enter the profound states of consciousness. He is one who can realize that state of the cessation of perception and feeling. And in the process of the realization, every element of self disappears. You'll find in the Majjhima two discourses at least where it is clearly stated that whilst entering the third jhana, I did not know that I was entering it. Into the fourth, that I entered. Into the fifth, sixth, seventh. And then on emerging backwards, I did not know that I was emerging backwards. If there is the element of self, of selfness, if there is the consciousness of an I am I who is separate from others, is this possible? Is it possible to go through those jhanas? We have to consider this very, very carefully. For my part, I can't see that if one realizes arhatship, one is concerned for oneself to the exclusion of others. The whole element of exclusiveness vanishes from the scene. We must bear in mind one other factor. The Mahayana develops from about the time of Ashoka onwards, really develops, and this Bodhisattva ideal comes out. Before Ashoka, the laity supported the monks. There was a continuous interchange between the laity and the monks. When Ashoka established Buddhism as the state religion and financed it, so to say, then the touch with the laity became less strong. And it seemed to the laity as if the monks were unconcerned with us. To re-establish this contact, the monks produced, the Mahasanghikas produced this ideal. I'm putting extremely briefly what needs rather more exposition. And they presented it then as a superior ideal to that of the people who felt exclusively. But is there substantial truth in this? There is another approach to the whole question. Comparison divides. Where there is the absence of comparison, there is complete relationship. There is the wholeness. We can compare within limits. But when we go inwards, when we enter this truly religious context, which is the context of the transcendent, what happens to comparison? Comparison vanishes from the picture. Can you compare where there is perfection of any sort? We all know how when we are young, we have endless arguments. Oh, who wrote better symphonies, or who painted more beautiful pictures? Or in ordinary life, if two youngsters get to quarreling as to who is the more beautiful girl, you know exactly what happens. There is vain and useless quarreling and discord in a situation of complete untruth. Comparison vanishes very quickly as you enter the deeper states. Where perfection, where the transcendent, where the heart of religion is concerned, there is no such thing as comparison. This is human folly. And this, surely, historically, we know as one of the great dividers, the great schism makers between man and man. Hardly compassionate, is it, to say that my ideal of compassion is superior to your selfish ideal? It is really the failure of compassion, as well as the failure of wisdom, which will introduce comparisons of this sort. That is how I see it. I don't see the one as superior or inferior to the other. Then again, we may consider the actual verbal formulation. The Bodhisattva ideal, I renounce my entry into nirvana and shall wait until every blade of grass has entered nirvana. It's a lovely sentiment. Perhaps it's a poetic expression. It's a profound sentiment, yes. A noble drive. But suppose we look at it in its wholeness. Just what does it mean? What does it mean in actual fact, in the sense of what happens? Can anything like I wait at the threshold of nirvana until every other person and even every blade of grass has realized nirvana? Are not these words rather unfortunate? Moved by a fine emotion, one gives utterance, perhaps, to poetic speech. But just a little bit unreal. I leave it to you to consider entirely.
Is the I?
Precisely. This is how it is put. I renounce nirvana. My entry into nirvana. And if you want to go further, is it possible for this to renounce nirvana? It's impossible. Look at it another way, if you like. You can give up that which you already have. But if I haven't got nirvana, what am I renouncing? It's like the beggar in the street who say, "Oh, I renounce the whole kingdom." He isn't king of the kingdom. He can't renounce it. One has to be very careful never to take leave of good sense. Every year I say this at the summer school. Never take leave of good sense. And we must distinguish good sense from common sense. Common sense is possessed by the cleverest rascals of the world. Good sense is possessed by the one who lives the pure life. He has good sense. Let's go on. Now, between about 100 BC and 200 AD, Mahayana literature blossoms out. Its spirit with particular force is expressed in writings like The Lotus of the Good Law and The Exposition of Vimala Kirti. The core of it, however, comes out in the Prajnaparamita, which means literally the wisdom gone beyond, or transcendental wisdom. Now the Prajna Paramita originates in southeast India. It's a strange thing that centuries later the great Shankara also arose in southeast India. He who re-established Hinduism rather firmly throughout the length and breadth of the land. Near Amaravati and Nagarjunikonda, between the rivers Krishna and Godavari. The doctrine developed in systematic and philosophic form was developed in systematic and philosophical form by the Madhyamikas, that is, those who took the middle way between affirming and denying. They took the middle way between affirming and denying. Now the root of this comes in the Buddha's discourse to Kacchayana, where the Buddha says, on the one hand, people affirm, it is, or this is so. On the other hand, they say, this is not so. The truth lies in the middle. And he expounds this truth which lies in the middle in terms of the formula of the Paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination. And if one really understands this dependent origination, one is unable legitimately to affirm positively this is or this is not. In a certain sense it is, in a certain sense it is not also. He who sees uprising cannot deny it is. He who sees ceasing to be cannot deny it is not. And so forth. Madhyama also is the transcendent. If you take the Theravada presentation, for instance, of the middle way, you will find that every single aspect of it is prefixed by the word sama. Sama means right, true enough. It also means perfect. The perfect way is not a middle way between the world's goodness and the world's badness. The world's goodness is here and the world's badness is here. You don't just draw a line between the joining the two and say, oh, we'll tread the middle path. We shall strike a compromise, in other words. No compromises. If you look at the statements in the Pali Canon, the perfect way, perfect understanding, perfect effort, perfect speech, perfect action, perfect thought, perfect mindfulness, and perfect samadhi, communion if you like to so translate it. Because in the state of the real samadhi, one is in communion with totality. See? These perfections, it's the perfect way. What has it to do with something in the middle, a middling way? It's not a middling way, which is usually a muddling way, as we know politically and in various other ways. It's not a muddling way, not a middling way. It is the perfect way. It's the apex in the transcendent. And it is a way which is supremely austere. There is no halfway house about it. This we must remember in connection with the word Madhyama, or Majjhima as in the Pali, which is used in connection with Buddhism. This doctrine, founded about 150 AD by the Brahmin, remember he was a Brahmin to start with, Nagarjuna, and Aryadeva. Nagarjuna's theory, of course, is the great emptiness doctrine, the Shunyavada. And about 450 AD, the Madhyamika school split into two groups. The Prasangikas, who interpreted Nagarjuna's doctrine as a universal skepticism, refuting all others, and the Svatantrikas, who maintained that the dialectic method could also establish some positive truths, not merely confine itself to refuting everybody else. Now, all Buddhism disappeared from India after 1000 AD, particularly with the destruction of the great Buddhist foundations of Vikramasila, Odantapuri, and so on. And there were eight great establishments like that. And they all were destroyed by the conquering Mohammedans. And Nalanda, of course, the great place. The Madhyamika's leading ideas, however, survived for a time, and they were incorporated by Shankara and Gaudapada in the Vedanta and in various other ways too. The Prajnaparamita influenced China and Japan, and those two countries adapted it to their own outlook on life, and of course we have Chan and Zen. But otherwise, the Madhyamika philosophy and movement as such finally perished in India itself. Now let us look into the main elements of this Prajnaparamita. There are keywords. Bodhisattva is one keyword. And Bodhisattva means literally enlightenment being. It is a conception which is not an original creation of the Mahayana. It already is fully formed in the Abhidharma Kosha of the Sarvastivadins. The Mahayana elaborated the idea into an ideal valid for all. As we have already considered, it compared the arhat unfavorably with the bodhisattva. It said that the arhat had not completely shaken off all attachment to the I, and of course the selfish nirvana idea was put forward. Whereas the all-compassionate Bodhisattva abandoned the world but not the beings in it. This is the important point about it. In the discipline, one did not grasp at anything. One renounced the world. That is to say, essentially, one renounced all worldliness. All worldliness. But the Mahayana stressed, abandon the world, abandon all worldliness, but not the beings in the world. Live in service of them. You have, for instance, in Christian mysticism, the living of the unitive life. After one has realized the ultimate stage, what happens? You just come back. You have this in Zen too. The liberal, the realized one, comes back and sits in the marketplace, ready to help whoever needs the helping. I think it will be useful to read these two quotations from the Prajnaparamita. How do the persons belonging to the vehicle of the disciples and the Pratyeka Buddhas train themselves? Now this refers to the Theravadin presentation as such. They think one single self we will tame, one single self we will pacify, one single self we will lead into nirvana. Then they undertake exercises which bring about wholesome roots for the sake of taming themselves, pacifying themselves, nirvanizing themselves, putting themselves into nirvana, the condition of nirvana. Certainly, the bodhisattva should not train himself like that. He should undertake exercises for bringing about wholesome roots with the idea, myself I will place in suchness, tathata, which is the equivalent of nirvana. Myself, I will place in nirvana. And for the sake of helping all the world, I will also place all beings in suchness, nirvana. The immeasurable world of beings I will lead to nirvana. One may question, is an ideal an ambition or not? If it is an ambition, then is it compatible with liberation? Then the other quotation is this. The Prajnaparamita says, doers of what is hard are the bodhisattvas, the great beings who have set out to win supreme enlightenment. They do not wish to attain their own private nirvana. Again, one can challenge this statement. Private nirvana is a self-contradictory phrase. On the contrary, they have surveyed the highly painful world of being, and yet, desirous of winning supreme enlightenment, they do not tremble at birth and death. They have set out for the benefit of the world, for the ease of the world, out of pity for the world. They have resolved, we will become a shelter for the world, a refuge for the world, the world's place of rest, the final relief of the world, islands of the world, lights of the world, leaders of the world's means of salvation. It would not be difficult to find flaws in this verbal formulation all along the line. All these ideas, which are ideals, are after all projections out of my mind. The Buddha mind is the mind which is utterly free of all adventitious taints. When utterly free of all adventitious taints, it does not project anything and set it up as an ideal or whatever it is. It doesn't do it. But these are projected out of one's own mind. And the projection will naturally have its own particular limited and limiting shape with the defects inherent in it. What am I doing leading other people into nirvana? You see the problem, you see the difficulty. Consider again another point. In ancient India, what did your liberated one do, your holy one do? He just lived in the adjoining forest land. He just lived by himself, and whosoever desired wisdom came to him. He didn't say to anybody, oh, come along, I will show you the path to liberation. If somebody desired, was really keen, and came, then he gave unto that one what he could give, what was useful for him. This is how it went on for over a millennium before the birth of the Buddha. And as far as I'm aware, the Buddha did not say to so and so and so and so, come to me. When so and so came, and the Buddha spoke to him, and that person's mind and heart opened out, then he gave them the teaching which the Buddhas had won, the Four Noble Truths.
Of course, it is said that in past lives, as a bodhisattva, he had this aspiration. But this is stated by those who came after the Buddha lived and died. Therefore, people who were capable of projecting ideals out of their own minds. Our ideals trap us and bind us just as much, sometimes even more, than if we are free of ideals. Now, this bodhisattva ideal was inherent in the practice of the Brahma Viharas, the meditations which deal with metta, karuna, loving kindness, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekha, perfect equanimity. These meditations cultivate relations to people as persons. So you see, the Buddha himself, on the one hand, taught, see every action, thing, feeling, thought, mood, whatever it was, with right wisdom. Anicca, impermanent, dukkha, representing ill, the state of unease, and itself a source of ill, and anicca, dukkha, and anatta, without any permanent entity, without self-nature, permanent self-nature in it. On the one hand, he taught that. On the other hand, where persons were concerned, unto all, metta, karuna. It is emphasized over and over again. For instance, in the Kakupama, which is one of the early suttas in the first volume of the Majjhima, where the Buddha tells his bhikkhus, even if low down thieves were to carve you limb from limb, even then you should not let your minds be filled with enmity against them. You should let your minds be filled with loving kindness for them. And starting with the low-down thief who carves you limb from limb, extend that mind of loving kindness to all the world, all the quarters of the world, and all that there are in it. Now you see, this really was the root of this Mahakaruna of Mahayana. The dharmas contemplate, the contemplation of the dharmas, that is wisdom, dissolves other people as well as myself. Whereas the meditations which are the Brahma Viharas cultivates relations between people. Instead of dissecting them into impermanent dharmas, you accept them as organic wholes who are their people. Because, think of it, if we were to dissect everybody and everything into just the dharmas, can we feel compassion for an ear element or a sound consciousness or some such thing? Or a bit of earth or water element or air element? It's just absurd, isn't it? When we speak to each other, or if we want somebody to call somebody, we don't say, oh, call five heaps. We just don't do that. We accept the empirical fact of here is a whole living human being. If you don't accept it, loving kindness, compassion could have no meaning. And unless that was accepted, how could the Buddha have given a teaching like, even if low down thieves carve you limb from limb,
Let your minds, your hearts be filled with loving kindness. The true task of the Buddhist then is to carry on with both the analytical wisdom aspect, which sees that this is impermanent, dukkha, anicca, anatta, to see that on the one hand, and on the other hand to have this, to acknowledge the empirical fact of living beings as such. Now the Diamond Sutra tells us two things are most needful to the Bodhisattva and to his practice of wisdom. Never to abandon all beings and to see into the truth that all things are empty. And it is necessary for us to understand the all-important teaching of emptiness. I see that it is about 12:20 now, is that so?
Yes.
Yes. Perhaps this will be a good point to break off. Tomorrow we shall complete the general view of the Mahayana and we'll go into this doctrine of emptiness, shunyata, and a few words upon salvation as presented in the Mahayana. And then if we have a little time, we'll look into some of the actual sayings from the Prajnaparamita. Some very important sayings indeed. Thank you very much.